Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we're just talking about this apparent disparity between what reliability textbooks say you need to do and what we believe you actually should do in most reliability applications.
Well, wait a sec, Chris. You wrote a textbook. I've seen it. It's not physical. It's like 780 pages digitally.
I think it's close to 1,000 pages of absolute gold, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yep.
But I grew up with Iris, Coombs, and Moss as the Reliability Engineering and Management Handbook. And it really was a handbook. You could dive into all kinds of everything from FMEA to PetriNet, and modeling and just about everything in between. And it went over some important concepts and all that other stuff. But it was I think second or third edition that I was in. O'Connor was, I think, at third edition at that point. They're now at fifth edition. But they all have MTBF in it, for example.
Mm-hmm. And I believe you provide a few resources, Fred, to people who wanting to understand why we shouldn't be using the MTBF. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. But the issue is, in the webinar you did at the end of January, and this will come out in a couple of weeks, you did earlier this week as we're recording it, you mentioned that, here's what's available in textbooks commonly. Mm-hmm. If somebody wanted to go figure out how many spares I need to have on the shelf for a particular unit, and I have some time to failure type information, there's some basic calculations, either from a logistics point of view and counting for, delay time and lots orders and all that other stuff. There's kind of nuances to that to get it right. Economic purchase quantity, all that kind of stuff. And then there's just the basics. Well, how many are going to fail over the next week? And how many spares do I need to have on the shelf for that? Not counting safety stock and all kinds of other stuff. But the idea was that you brought it back to, and which triggered me to want to talk to you about it, is the textbooks will have calculate the mean, calculate the standard deviation. In the quality textbooks, they often talk about the normal distribution. And then they might make mention of a few other distributions, but they almost exclusively talk about the normal. So I'm taking this out of the reliability part so I don't get too wrapped around the axle on MTBF. And this is so pervasive that one of the clients I'm working with right now is getting feedback from the FDA, from whoever it is that's overseeing their submissions, that their data has to be in normal distribution before they can use it for further analysis. And so they're kind of tossing out points saying, well, those are two outliers, but if I take them out, it turns the rest of the distributions normal. Is that okay? He says, no, that's not okay. And another one was the process itself clips the data set, right? There's no way it could be normal. Uh-huh. Another one is it's a clear wear mechanism, and it's a viable beta 2 distribution. It's just what it is. And from just what the nature of the failure mechanism is, as I said, I bet you that's a viable distribution. So, well, how'd you know? I says, that always happens with that kind of failure mechanism. Uh-huh. But the FDA saying we have to make it a normal, and we're having trouble converting it into a normal distribution, or transforming it into normal, or getting rid of a few data points so it kind of is close enough to normal. And I thought, that's ridiculous. Everything's not a normal distribution. that's just fact. And no matter how much you wish it was a normal distribution, because that's all that you can find in your textbook on introduction to quality or statistics, doesn't make it that's your only option. I find that some of our introductory textbooks don't go far enough to say this is a teaching method, not the rule. End a rant.
It's worth that, but it's worth understanding the history as to why we see this bell curve sort of superimposed and what seems like every reliability problem, or bell curve or the MCBF. I think they're the two things which are always carpet bombed over every single reliability problem in a lot of textbooks. And I think it's fair to point out, though, back in the 1960s and 70s, when reliability engineering techniques were first starting to become formalized, that's before people had, you know, advanced calculators even. And so you had to solve statistical problems, you had to manually go to the back of a textbook which had a hard copy normal distribution probability table. And so you would have to try and exploit approximations to the bell curve to try and turn it into something which this probability table at the back of a textbook could then become useful for.
Well, I remember even seeing Dick Moss, actually, when I was at Hewlett-Packard. I was talking to him about a problem, and he goes, oh, well, that's that. If we think of it as attribute data and a pass-fail, we can use the cumulative binomial distribution for that. And he opened up his desk drawer and pulled out a laminated copy of the back of a textbook with the cumulative binomial distribution table on it. That's how he solved problems. That's how he got it there.
Yeah, and I'm assuming you're talking about essentially, you know, binomial problems where you have special tables for 50 trials, for example, and it gives you the probability of you seeing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all up to 50 failures for a certain failure probability.
Yeah, it was similar to that. Yeah, it was the kind of thing, but it's very similar to the normal curve. And for those that really got into the deeper chapters, they saw the F distribution, so they could do ANOVA tables. But I agree with you, is that 50s and 60s, we had slide rules. And doing a computation that had exponents and a lot of calculus involved with it and everything else, it could be done. It was very tedious. As an aside, my mom years ago visited me in my office, and I had a workstation on my desk, and I was able to do all kinds of fancy stuff with it for the time. I think my phone does more fancy stuff than it can do. It could do. And she goes, why do you need such a fast computer? I said, so I can do these calculations. Well, why can't you do those by hand? I says, it would take 40 of us, 10 years to solve this problem. It was some finite element analysis problem. And he goes, well, that's 40 people that don't have a job. Okay, mom. Where do you want to go for lunch?
Yes, that's a very unionistic approach to statistics. But you raise a point that back in the day, that's all you had, and I think that all we can aspire to do as engineers is to exploit the state of the art. And the state of the art back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was to use hard copy tables from the back of textbooks, because that literally was the state of the art. The problem is that, you know, for whatever reason, maybe people have become accustomed to these approaches or comfortable with these approaches, or perhaps my best guess is make money out of being seen as the experts of these approaches. They now still appear in textbooks to this day, and the reality is they're spreading a false message that these will give you the answer you're after. When, you know, we looked at an example where if you use the old school methodology, you could in a real life scenario, the old school methodology suggested you needed to have 5 very expensive mining truck engines on site as spares, versus using what we know today to revise that figure down to 3. Now, that's a saving of almost $2 million. And as you know, engines that sit on shelves and warehouses and mine sites across the world for two or three years, they tend not to be very, very good at the end of that that storage period. So just simply refusing to move on from the old school ways could cost you millions of dollars in just essentially wasted money on logistics if you don't really want to take the time to really understand what's going on, which is probably the nub of the issue. You can take the time to understand how your component and system behaves versus assume it's like the very basic component or system that we had to assume everything was back in these 90s and 50s and 60s textbooks.
Well, you know, there's still a lot of value in a lot of these old papers and breakthroughs in the textbooks and stuff. It's just in our application of it. And at RAMS years ago, I was sitting down next to a professor that had just done a tutorial that was full of, you know, the MTBF and chi-square distributions and stuff like that. And I'm like, why do you teach this stuff? You know that you don't, there's very little application for these things. And he says, well, I only get 2 hours here, and I want to bring across, I was trying to teach the course so that people would understand what a PDF, CDF, reliability function, hazard function were. That was, and then I used the exponential distribution to do that. He says, well, but you also went into, you know, you can add the failure rates and all these other nuances of it that are unique to the exponential distribution that really streamline the calculations if the underlying assumptions are correct, that this constant hazard rate deal works. And goes, yeah, that's a benefit of it all. And I don't think it is. I think that this concept of teaching this because it's a way to get a simple distribution in to teach these more complex concepts without stepping out of that saying, well, now let's do a Weibull. Now let's do a log normal. Now let's go into the normal and where they're, how they apply to PDF, CDF, and so on. And he just didn't get that. He didn't understand that. People can do that. And he says, they don't. And then the other driving force that's reinforcing this is the bodies of knowledge. The ASQ-CRE body of knowledge continues to do MTBF and MTTF and chi-squared distributions and so on, and parts count prediction and lots and lots of questions and testing on the exponential distribution. And so you and I have both taught CRE prep courses, and we'll teach that stuff holding our nose and go, and then advise our students to never use it. You know, you need it for the exam, but then dump it. You never want to see this again because it's really going to give you bad information. Now, when I look at mechanical engineering and working with a couple of my clients and in the mechanical engineering designers, they're using SolidWorks or some whiz-bang computer-aided design system, and they can run finite element analysis. They can look at moments of bend and stress and loads, and they can look at vibration impact and transfer of loads on their desktop at a regular course of business. There's no way they could have done that 20, 30 years ago.
No.
But they're, everybody I talk to now is using this software and doing that because it's invaluable for them to make a good design. So by analogy, reliability is not moving ahead because our tools and education continue to propagate. Well, just add the failure rates, you'll be fine.
And it's just, I mean, it's sad to say, we don't want to appear as complaining too much. Well, maybe we do. I don't know. But
it's a rant. This one's a rant.
reliability engineering is often seen as an embuggerance. It's often seen as something you need to do, a gate you need to pass through to get wherever you are, from wherever you are to wherever you need to be. And The less interference you get from the reliability guys, the better. And that, you know, because there's no tangible link between the value of reliability engineering, and we talk about how reliability engineering is not just solving problems that your customers find for you, it's actually a well done for me at the start, will just eliminate 90% of your production issues. They'll eliminate all those issues where your tolerances don't line up, and a well done for me actually the first effect you experience is just a production budget that is very, very low, and also time to market is accelerated because you don't have to keep fighting fires during production.
Mm-hmm.
But that link to value is just not widespread, which it means that people aren't willing to invest time and money into improving the state of the art for those things they don't see any value in. So finite element analysis and obviously SolidWorks and other CAD stuff where you can not only design stuff, but essentially in a theoretical way, put parts together and see where one part's going to hit another part if it pivots around current pivot point, all those sorts of things, which mm-hmm. prevent problems later on. You can do exactly the same thing with reliability engineering. It's not nearly as visible or perhaps sexy, but they're the problems that you're going to, they're the expensive problems that you can avoid by doing a good FMEA. But because, you know, people aren't really, a lot of organizations don't link the value of reliability to at least their own personal professional development. It's just, okay, what do I need to do to get through this gate? Give me the simplest equation. I don't want to think about it. How many samples do I need? How many things do I need to do to part? All those sorts of basic mm-hmm. questions, which doesn't lend itself to really getting to the nub of the problem.
It reminds me of, this concept that you mentioned of, well, reliability is not seen as a value center, right? Way back when I was part of Hewlett Packard, we merged. I think both sides claim they bought the other one with Compact. And Compact at the time, and for years later, had in Houston, where their campus was, they had a Six Sigma class. And so I thought, oh, well, that sounds interesting. So I talked to them a little bit, and they let me sign up for the class. And I was thinking that we're going to get, like, tolerance analysis and capability studies and mm-hmm. designing it right. And, you know, this is really good stuff I could use for reliability. No, it had nothing to do with that. And I asked him about it, and he says, well, the math is too hard for our students. So we dropped all the math parts. So they did brainstorming and fishbone diagrams and stuff like that. That's the most sophisticated they got. And then part of the project or part of the course is, but you had to have a project, and then you had to, you know, work through the project and get a demonstration of how valuable it was. And you know, there was estimates, ways of estimating value and all the other stuff. And he says, well, would a comment from, you know, a division chair or a general manager of a major product line saying how much it's worth, would that suffice to quantify the value? And they go, oh yeah, that would work real well. And I said, great. And I knew that in the 5 or 6 years that this group had been running these courses, the sum total of savings that accumulated from all the projects they did from all kinds of disciplines, all kinds of areas, was on the order of like $40 million. And that was hundreds and hundreds of projects. And so this particular project, which I spent 2 weeks on doing some research, which was pivotal for a team to make a decision, which saved them $100 million. And that was the quote from this general manager, this program manager. And, you know, in one short project, actually doing the math and understanding the chemistry and doing the underlying analysis of it, you know, more than doubled the returns that this program had. And I didn't do a fishbone diagram at all. and so they kind of, well, and they said they were flabbergasted that reliability could have that much impact. Just absolutely blown away. They were actively discouraging people from doing stuff on reliability. And I said, no, you really need to look at this in a different way. We have over $1 billion in warranty that if you cut that in half, that could be caused by astute black belt practitioners solving problems, but you're ignoring the opportunity there. Yeah, and they never went into that. They just could not fathom getting into reliability type projects. Just, it blew me away.
Yep. And that's it. I mean, there's no pretense that there is a desire to even try and add value to reliability. And it's cultural. It's people are brought up to make, you know, they get promoted to where they are as managing directors because they are the guys who are able to always be on time and on budget, get promoted before the
reliability results came in.
Correct. Yeah. You know, it's the high flyers get promoted quickly. And the higher you fly, the quicker you get promoted. But those organizations where the height of your flight is based on meeting your quarterly budget and schedule goals, you're seen as a star, but all you do is quickly rocket out of the supernova you've just left behind. And often, when reliability is not a thing, it's very easy to pass the blame around If you don't know how your thing went wrong, how your thing failed, then it's very easy to say it was the supplier's fault or this engineer's fault, and not have that, not be able to have the argument destroyed, because because there's no reliability capacity in the first place, there's no one who's able to say, well, it wasn't that, because I know what the true cause of failure was, and oh, it's just a mess, you know.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to these textbooks we got and we were talking earlier today about, you know, articles and writing stuff and things like that. And I tend to write a lot of fundamental or basic articles. I mean, it's just because there's a demand for it. Somebody's going to Google, how do I do X? And then here's info on it. Luckily, all of you alluded to it earlier, is somebody Googles MTBF, they'll probably find one of my articles on don't use it. You know,
yeah.
eight great reasons never to use, you know, this measure, and so on. And so the education is going on. It's making progress. The stalwart programs and software packages, and I've talked to software people, they say, well, the primary default output is MTBF because that's what our customers demand or expect. And he says, well, how do they know any different if you don't actually give them the real answer so they can compare that? And, well, that's too much work. Okay, I get it now. You know? So anyway, I think there's a number of cultural pieces between software packages, between book publishers, between authors that don't want to do the work of getting a coherent message that takes using a little more sophisticated set of tools. All of those things are forcing us to stay in the 70s. And I think that's unfortunate, but hopefully not through Ascendo. We don't do that too much at Ascendo.
Well, I think you're being too kind. I think you're just saying it's just a factor of textbooks not being as updated or reviewed as often as they should be. I think it's actually a bit more challenging than that. And I think it's just, I'll be honest, I think there's a lot of reliability engineers out there who've made a living based on these very simplistic applications of statistics, and they don't have the brains to do anything more than that. And it's in their interest, to be honest, to keep peddling how these approaches are the only way or the best way of doing things. Because if they don't, then they're out of a job or they're no longer relevant.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, there are software, reliability software, where you see confidence bands at trade shows and things like that, which go back down as opposed to continually going up on the CDF. Now, if you don't know what that means, then you're going to continue to use these outdated approaches and make potentially catastrophic financial decisions. But for those of you who actually know what it means, how a confidence band on a CDF, a cumulative distribution function, how bad it is if you have a model which suggests the confidence band will go up and then start going down, which implies that if your product gets older, once it gets through a certain phase, it's going to be less likely to have failed in the past. It's just principally insane. But if we actually point out that this is not valid, this doesn't work, then you'll have entire software packages which are fundamentally flawed and no longer profitable because they're based on outdated algorithms.
Yep.
And they have a workforce that know no better, and you have customers that know no better. So I honestly think that most of it is because there are reliability engineers out there who don't have the ability to take the statistics to the next level, and for them to remain relevant, they have to try and peddle the old stuff.
Yeah. No, well, of course, though, Chris, it's none of our listeners are in that bucket. They ask the right questions. They challenge assumptions. They look for the appropriate solutions. I mean, that's obvious. Only the best people listen to our podcast. So,
absolute geniuses.
Yeah, every single one of them. But the idea is, you know, think about it. Where are you getting? Is there something more that you could be doing that gives you a better answer or gives you a cleaner answer or gives you more precision or, you know, insight or whatever? I don't think we have to be limited by what's available in our particular software package. That just doesn't make much sense. If a pencil isn't suiting you, you get a pen. and you get a better technology or different technology to solve the problem. So I think that applies here. So if you're listening to this and, you know, I don't know if your head's nodding or you're are well ahead of us on this and going, well, you guys should get better microphones. Your technology needs updating, which is fair. Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR and let us know what you think. You know, what drives your use of tools and technology to solve problems? What's limiting you from doing what you want to, you know, you should be doing? And those might make some really good topics for future discussions. So with that, Chris, we'll see what we get. We always get some nice comments. Appreciate that. It's good to know folks are listening, and we'll see how it goes from there.
Absolutely. As always, Fred, good to talk.
All right. Talk to you later, Chris. Cheers.
Cheers, Fred. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.